Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to the June 24th, 2019 For Your Benefit show. Special show today. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, consultant, and what else?
Oh, you name it. If you give me a job to do, I'll try to do it.
And well, and Joe Selvander, much the same, but Joe dwells on the financial planning side of life.
That's correct.
And worked with feds for 30 years?
25. Don't age me quite that much.
All right. No, not that you look it. Anyway, so, and I'm Bob Lyons. I'm a tax type, and I'm going to listen to these two folks and give me some advice going into the future. So going out, what do you want to talk about first? We bounced this around before we went on air, folks, but I'm not so sure where we landed.
Well, I was looking forward to this show because Joe and I follow each other at seminars around the Beltway that we do. And sometimes, you know, we bring up topics that overlap, you know, whether it's electing a survivor benefit, especially if you're married to another federal employee, whether it's taking Medicare or electing to take Social Security. So I thought it might be fun if we talk about some of these topics that overlap and look at them from both a benefits perspective and a financial planning. So, you know, the whole course of our day when we're talking about benefits starts with either FERS or CSRS, you know, the basic government pension. And there's a lot of decisions there, whether it's from the day to retire or electing a survivor benefit, that can have big financial planning impacts. So I think that's one of the places I'd like to start. What about you, Jim?
That sounds good. Yeah.
All right. How about this? When people ask you the questions, is there a certain number of questions that you're surprised that they're asking that they didn't know they had an annuity or they didn't know they had a pension or they didn't know how it worked?
It depends. Depends on how much time they've been studying it before they come into class. But it does surprise us sometimes that we'll meet people that don't know they have a government pension and they've been in the government 20 years. So, you know, those do surprise me, but I'm not totally surprised because when you see how much you contribute to the FERS retirement system, it's a very small amount. So it's maybe not so surprising that some employees don't realize the value of that pension benefit.
That's the point of the seminars, too, is to educate people on these things, you know, to where some folks just haven't sat down and looked through all the details of their benefits. They might know they have some pension and they know how the TSP works, but they don't necessarily know how it all works together. And that's what I think that we do.
So, Joe, when somebody comes to see you, you would hope that they had done some studying about their annuity or you're going to enlighten them that they have one.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I always tell people you don't need, at the point of sitting down with a financial planner or even a benefits consultant like Tammy is not necessarily that you're an expert on all of this. I mean, even if the person has no idea what they have, we can sit down and explain it and present it to them. Or if they do know what they have but don't know how it all works together, we can do that too.
Tammy, when you talk to folks, if you were to be not surprised, but you go, gee, I thought that was somewhat common knowledge. Is there several or one thing that maybe they don't walk in with? Not everyone, but more than you'd be surprised with.
Well, it depends. I kind of categorize students from one of two points of view. Either one, where they come into the classroom and they've studied this for 30 years and they think they know pretty much everything there is to know. And that's a challenge for me to try to tell them something they didn't know. And I usually can because I study this every day, you know, for 35 mm-hmm. years. But then you have the other student that comes in from square one. And I like that student too, because that's the one who you really start from square one and say, you know, this is what your three-tiered system looks like. This is how you get from point A to point B. So I enjoy both. I enjoy the challenge of telling somebody who thinks they know everything something new, and usually I can find something, or to tell someone who's just starting out, this is overwhelming to them, and try to just break it down and make it simple. And I enjoy simplifying some of these complicated concepts.
I'd say for me, it's overcoming the conservatism, if you will, of, you know you have a pension benefit or an annuity benefit, you know you have the TSP, you know you're going to get Social Security if you're FERS. They know all these things, but haven't put them all on the page together to translate it into the reality of their life, you know, and that's what I see missing a lot. And what I try to provide is we know how this stuff maybe works mechanically or have a basic understanding of it, but haven't looked at it all as a cohesive plan.
Do probably most come in know that they have this thing called an annuity, but I'm not so sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, the coordination of then the finances, distributions mm-hmm. from a thrift, et cetera, or claiming Social Security. That's a tough, it would be a tough one for me because that's calculation.
Well, even mm-hmm. the word annuity, I think, can get people confused because we use that kind of freely. Because when you're talking about civil service or FERS, that pension benefit is a form of an annuity. It's a lifetime payment. And oftentimes we associate the word annuity with the insurance industry because there are life insurance annuities that you can purchase that mm-hmm. Joe could talk about. And then even Social Security, from some respects, is an annuity. So I think part of it, too, is just simplifying the words that we use when we're talking to people to make sure they understand what page we're on. Sometimes you say that and they think it's thrift and we're really talking about FERS.
So can we call it an earned annuity versus a purchased annuity?
Or annuity payments. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some people are programmed or have read the literature to feel like annuities are bad. They're something that I shouldn't look at or have. And the reality is all an annuity is a check you get every month for the rest of your life. And it can come in the form of the FERS or CSRS annuity, or you can take a chunk of money and purchase a product through an insurance company that has the option of being annuitized and creating lifetime payments as well. And they're two really separate things.
One you really worked a career for, right?
One you really don't have a choice about. I mean, your money's being taken out of your paycheck and you're getting it as a benefit. The other one is a voluntary move to take money, a lump sum of money, and convert it to a lifetime series of payments.
Okay, once they realize that and they're going to receive X dollars, do you find a common issue with this isn't going to cover my lifestyle? Now, remember, we haven't touched the other two. We haven't touched the thrift. We haven't touched Social Security. Are they surprised at that? And then where do you go next? Which one do you take from first? Now, that's probably a three-hour show, but just a thousand-mile view.
I can give you two answers to that and I'll do it quickly. First of all, I always try to look at everything on a net basis. I think that's helpful to people. When you don't do it that way, it makes it more complicated and people get confused. What I like to look at is, what is your net take-home pay? Subtract from that what you're saving. That's what you're living off of. I mean, that's what you need to live. If you wake up tomorrow and don't go to work, that's what you need in your bank account. So then get an estimate of your retirement on a net basis, Social Security, any other income you have coming in, and I call it the gap. What's the gap between the two? And I'll just tell you, anecdotally, people are generally surprised when they look at it on paper that way. Then you can factor in, if you really, like you mentioned, some people are much more into this than others, you can go in and say, well, when I retire, I won't have these commuting expenses, or I'm going to move and have a lower house payment, or my kids will be financially on their own, you know, those sorts of things. And you might weigh the numbers and find that it actually works quite well.
Okay. But then you'll have 50 hours a week more to spend the money.
That's true. That is true.
And I'll just bring tax into this a little bit, because we can only spend what we bring home. And what we bring home with the W-2, we pretty much know what to have withheld to cover our taxes. But in retirement, the annuity, again, allows us to do pretty much what we want. But the thrift is rather restrictive as to what federal withholding, and not so sure about the state. And Social Security, there's only maybe two options. Otherwise, you have to tell them what you want. So FERS people, at least I find, they're confused tax-wise, or they didn't know that the taxes were not being withheld enough.
Right.
And I don't want to talk too much about taxes, but taxes do impact bring-home pay.
It does.
Yeah. And you asked the second question in there that relates to taxes, which is, say your retirement check's going to be $1,000 a month short from what you need to live. Where do I take that additional money from? Do I take it from thrift, savings, so forth? To me, that really fundamentally becomes a tax question. I mean, I can take the money out of my savings, because that's the first place I would go, because there's no taxes, there's no fees, there's no downside. And when that's spent, then go to maybe capital gain-oriented investments, taxable brokerage accounts, and then the TSP last. So I think one mistake I would just throw in here people make is, I need the extra $1,000 a month, I've got my TSP, that's where I should take it. I don't always agree with that, because that's taking money out of an account that's taxable as income rather than
letting it grow tax-deferred.
Then letting it grow tax-deferred and taking money out of a place that doesn't have that tax advantage.
Okay, now you being the investment guru, when I structure the investment or I ask for some help, Do you break it into, okay, there's X percent of the dollars have to be somewhat demand money. If I need it, it's got to be there. And the rest would be, well, I don't need it, but I might need it later. And then there might be a third pot that says at age 70 or at 80, mm-hmm. Then I'm going to go into that pot. Do you get that detailed?
Yeah. In fact, and not to go too deep into this, but the way that I try to run it is what I have something I call a max income illustration, which I think is really useful. So somebody might say, I need $6,000 a month net to live. We'll run the plan for that. We'll see if it works. Great. You can retire. That math works fine. But what if we needed $8,000 a month, $9,000 a month, $10,000 a month? And I keep pushing the plan until it breaks. And if I tell you, tell you when you retire, you only need $6,000 a month to live, but you could spend $10,000. Well, that gives you $4,000, what's that, $50,000 a year in leeway. Now, you may not use that every single year, but if you need a new car or if you want to go on a trip, you don't feel this you know, tension of, oh, if I pull the money out of my investments, now I'm going to run out. You know, you've got that perspective. So that's the way I handle it. I like to look at it as kind of a max income. Like, how much cushion? I mean, are you retiring and living off $6,000 a month and literally that's it? You know, if anything happens, you're going back to work. We don't want that.
Could I ask, these would be individual questions, since Joe, you've got the floor right now. If you were to look at, what are some of the biggest surprises or disappointments you had when you told people this? Well, I can't get that much money, or I can't touch it because it's for later usage.
That's you've articulated it perfectly. That's the big disappointment. And, you know, we've all sort of anecdotally seen people that we know that are conservative and reluctant to spend the money even when they can afford to do it. And then they finally retire and they don't live very long, or their health isn't very good. And so I preach about this a lot lately. I've seen, you know, we always worry I'm going to retire too soon and run out of money. And that's all the TV commercials are about that. That's what everyone worries about. I think the other thing is something we got to think about too, is that we work and work and work and save and save and save and don't do what would deprive ourselves. And then we get to a certain age where we think, okay, now I've got the money, now I can relax, now I don't have to work, and it's kind of too late to really enjoy it.
Okay. Now, Tammy, on your side, and consulting with them to put the basket together, minimum the annuity and then thrift or not, or Social Security or not, what have you found the biggest impediment for the people to understand?
Well, sometimes whenever someone says I'm eligible to retire, you know, I'm 57, I've got my 30 years that came at the same time, so I'm leaving. And the reality is sometimes when you're 57 with 30 years, that's not going to be enough to match what you need to spend every month. And you're going to maybe live possibly another 40 years at 57. So is that going to really last you a lifetime? So maybe the idea is to work a few years longer. Just 2 or 3 years can make a huge difference in how much your savings can grow, how much you're going to add to your FERS benefit. Maybe get closer to 62 when cost of living adjustments start kicking in for FERS. So if you looked at the numbers, OPM says the majority of retirees, more than half, retire when they're 62 or older. So it's not unlikely for a federal employee who might be eligible to retire at 56 or 57 to actually work another 4 or 5 years. And then that's much more comfortable. Then it's closer to what Joe's getting at.
There's an overlap point here too, which is I've run the math for people on these things, and I can tell you firsthand that you mentioned if you work 2 or 3 more years, the impact it can have. I've seen 6 months. I've seen 1 year. When you're between 57 and 62 in particular, where just that extra year, I mean, if you think about it, you're saving more money, your money's growing, your annuity's going up, which means you need less from your money when you retire. That, you know, so obviously the lesson I think we're both saying is you should be doing these calculations before you retire and not 2 years into retirement finding out that the money doesn't work.
Yeah. And another thing that I've noticed with people, and this is where I think there's a lot of overlap, because I always say tomorrow Joe's going to be here to talk about this, but you'll meet people who are 57 with 30 years that are thinking they're going to retire soon. So they've taken their TSP and they've moved it 100% to G. So is there ever a time when you should be 100% in the G fund if that's your only savings?
There could be a time. There's no wrong answer to how to allocate your TSP. It depends on your situation. What I made that groaning noise was, is anytime somebody does something that dramatic or that wholesale, that's the mentality of, I'm getting ready to retire, my TSP needs to be secure and safe. Well, not all of your TSP. Some of your money still has a 20, 25-year time frame. So in that respect, I would always cringe when somebody goes 100% seed, 100% G. If why would you be 100% G? I mean, if you don't need a tremendous amount of earnings and growth from your money, then basically you go 100% G.
Right. Maybe like a CSRS employee who retires and can live on their civil service benefit, and they've just, as a lark, saved in the thrift, and they managed to put aside 100 to sometimes – $500,000.
Right. And they don't need it, and they're conservative and just don't want to see any volatility.
Yep, that would make sense.
Okay, I think what makes sense is to listen to the commercial, because they deal with something outside of this, life insurance. And in the planning, there may be a need to look at this, but we'll let the commercial tell us about WEPA.
You have life insurance to protect the people you love. As a civilian federal employee, you have two choices designed specifically for you: WEPA and Fegley. The big difference? Price. Chances are WEPA premiums will cost you less. In fact, the average WEPA member saves $375 per year on premiums. Prioritize your peace of mind with a life insurance policy designed for feds by feds. If you're a civilian federal employee interested in comparing WEPA to Fegley, visit waepa.org today. WEPA is a proud sponsor of 4-Year Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Network, 1500 a.m. WEPA has been insuring the future of federal workers for more than 75 years. See why over 46,000 feds have already switched to WEPA at waepa.org.
Welcome back to 4-Year Benefit, and we're here today. We're talking about planning. We're talking about FERS, CSRS. And with I'm just sitting here taking notes. Tammy Flanagan, knower of all things federal, Joe, knower of all things finance, and I'm taking notes. Anyway, so we talked in general, but let's talk a little bit more specific with regards to TSP distributions. How do they work? I mean, can you take the money too early? Better not take it too late, but what happens? We got a lot of subject matter to cover between too early and too late, but what's too early?
Well, before you need it. That's a simple answer.
That's a great answer.
And I think that's one of the things I fight against, is folks that feel like, well, they've retired and they've accumulated all this TSP money, and now they can actually get it, and they should take out $1,000, $2,000 a month just because they're able to. And if that just then goes into your checking account and sits, well, then you're just basically taking money out of a tax shelter and paying taxes for no reason. So I tell people, don't take it out till you need it, which for a lot of people isn't until they're required to take it out at 70 and a half.
And even when they do, it's not a ton that's got to come out.
No.
First year, I think it's 3.65%.
That's right.
It goes up a little bit each year. But at the same time, it's going up. Hopefully so is the value, and maybe the value to be greater. But 10 years into it, it's 5.65%.
Right. But for a while, it tends to be less than what it's earning. You know, sometimes your mid, late 80s, depending on how aggressive or conservative you're investing, it starts to eat into the principal. And don't forget, people think, oh, I have to take it out. It's not gone. You know, you just pay taxes on it. And you can turn around and put it in an investment account if you don't want to spend it.
Okay, from the psychological side, people don't want to take it out, but then they're, quote, forced to take it out under this requirement. It's a poor choice of words, but it really are. It's required minimum distribution. But at that point, again, 75, 80, they're starting to maybe slow down, and they're getting more than they want to spend or can spend.
Right. That's true.
And what do you deal with then? Estate planning?
yeah, exactly. And then, like I said, you don't have to spend the money. You can just turn around and invest it somewhere else. But it would have to be outside of the tax-deferred shelter.
Are there any benefits of giving some of it away before you pass away? As Bob was talking about estate planning, could a financial planning strategy be, if you really don't need it and your plan is to give it either to a charity or maybe help your kids buy a house or something? Does that make sense from a financial point of view?
Yeah, giving your RMDs to charity is a really good move. because you're giving the money directly to the charity rather than paying taxes on it and then giving it to the charity.
It gets you around the taxes.
It gets you around the taxes. So that's a very common thing. You can echo that, our tax expert.
The taxes as well, and then there's this awful tax called the alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. And I don't even want to try to explain how it works, but it isn't going to work for the next 6 years because it got taken out of the law for most people until the law changes next time they rewrite it in 6 or 7 years. Is it 6 or 7? I should know. I think it's 6 years.
The one thing that doesn't make sense with the RMDs I want to throw in that I get a lot, you talk about surprising questions that you get, is the whole idea of I'm going to spend down my TSP aggressively. So when I have to take the RMDs, they're smaller. To me, that is the most illogical approach because now I'm going to pay all the taxes on the money early and get the money out of the TSP so it can be taxed additional, as it grows, just so that 3.65% is on a lower number. That I see a lot of people doing that, and that doesn't make much sense to me at all.
That's why they come to both of you. Or maybe maybe they should. Let's go each one of you. In talking with folks, what was maybe a surprising surprise as to what somebody didn't understand about one, the required minimum distribution at 70.5, or two, like Joe says, they don't take out enough because they're afraid that it's going to go away.
Well, a couple things. Number one, when Joe was talking about the minimal amount you have to take out for RMDs and how people sometimes try to strategize by taking money out ahead of when they have to, I think the only time when that might be a strategy is if they're in the income category where they're right on the threshold of paying more money for Medicare Part B. We have old Aunt Irma, which is the income-related Medicare adjustment amount for higher-income retirees. And when you have a dual-income couple and the threshold for that higher Medicare premium is $170,000 modified adjusted gross, that's in the area where a lot of our retirees happen to fall. So if they're in the category where they're just $10,000 over that, they're going to pay an extra $50 a month per person for Part B. So in that case, Joe might be the person to help them try to figure out how to get that income right below that threshold, maybe by taking less out of their savings or doing some other strategy like charitable donations or something to get that down, because it's just a fine line. If it's a dollar over that limit, you end up paying the higher Medicare Part B premium. But the other thing I was going to say that surprises a lot of people is the fact that they don't realize how long they're going to live. Everybody who retires thinks they have 10 years left. And in reality, if you look at the numbers, I just got some new statistics from OPM, and the number of retirees who are still around at age 85 is 125,000 on the regular rolls, let alone the survivor benefits. Those are getting close to 100,000 as well. And we actually have over 2,000 employee annuitants who are over age 100. So some of our federal retirees will make it, another 50 years after age 50.
That's getting the most out of your federal benefits
right
there.
That's right. Get your money's worth. Live a long time.
Joe, when you do your projections, that was a good comment. Yeah. Do you have, of course, you have different advice for, say, somebody early on, 55,
sure.
Probably the sweet spot of the people really in tune is going to be 60 to 65. What is surprising what you tell them that they didn't consider, like, gee, I didn't know I could do this, or how am I going to make my money last?
Yeah, I think they're surprised. If there's an easy answer to this, is surprised how the math all works over time. There's that fear that I can even hear it a little bit in some of the, I have it when Tammy's talking. I think, oh my goodness, all these people are going to live to 100. How are they going to make this work? But the impact of having a federal check that has a COLA attached to it that goes up throughout the rest of their life to provide them with a base amount of income. Some people it's everything they need. Some people it's a portion of what they need. That has an enormous impact. So a lot of the mass media that talks about financial planning, that talks to the private sector, you've got people retiring with a lump sum of money that they have to make last, and it could be 30, 35, 40 years of retirement, as she's pointing out. The federal employee has a real nice thing on their back, which is having this retirement check that helps bridge that gap. So some of the anxiety and fears, I think, of the private sector of living too long, I don't feel like apply at the same weight to a federal employee for that reason.
Okay, I've got an email question. It's got some, different sentences to it. I plan to retire at the end of July 2019. When can I roll over my TSP balance? Let's answer that now. There are three other questions that come up.
Well, that's a pretty easy question, because once you separate from the government, you're going to get kind of a welcome letter from the TSP saying that your payroll office has notified them that you've left, and here's all the options of what you can do with the money. You know, check tsp.gov and learn more about those. So usually it's within a month of your separation, you'll get the go-ahead, if you wanted to start taking money out of your thrift. But as Joe said, you don't have to. You know, unless you're past the age where you have to take required distributions, you can leave your TSP in there and let it continue to grow, you know, until you're 70 and a half or a little later.
And you can't do anything with it until, I think it's 30 days after
you
retire.
Yeah, it's about 30 days.
So I tell people, take it off your to-do list when you're preparing for retirement. Then retire.
Let the dust settle.
Let the dust settle. And you can always come back 6 months, a year later and say, all right, now, what's the smartest move with my TSP?
Okay, the next question was, should I call the TSP or the financial outfit that's going to accept the rollover transfer first? Which one do I call first?
Well, you have to have an IRA to roll it over into. So that would be the first step, would be to decide where you want to invest the money, open up an IRA there. So that is the first step. And then you fill out a form, TSP 70, that tells them to send the check to the company where the IRA is. So in essence, the answer is both, but I guess the first call would be the IRA.
Okay, and can they directly transfer it to?
Yes, and you want to directly transfer it as well so that they don't withhold any taxes.
And by the way, folks, never check the box rollover. Why? Because it's out of your hands at that point. And so you want to transfer it. In other words, a rollover, you're going to get the money, and then you have to do the legwork.
And you can do it partially. I think that's the other thing that's becoming, I see, is one of the more popular choices, because the TSP does allow you, if you leave the account open in retirement, you still have an account, you can roll that IRA back. So if you were to split it and then not be happy with the IRA or have other reasons why you wanted to move a portion of it back, it sort of gives you the most flexibility to maybe move part of it. So it's not a all or nothing decision.
Okay, we got a question, and you both talked about this before, but this is a real live question. Is it better for tax purposes to withdraw a yearly lump sum distribution, or should I use the 4% rule? First of all, what's the 4% rule?
The 4% rule is a loose way to figure out how long your money's going to last. You know, if I have $1 million and I want to live off of it, I shouldn't take out more than 4% a year. If I don't want it to run out, obviously we like to do financial planning with a little more sophistication, but it is a good sort of back of the napkin kind of way to figure that out. But again, this leads into what I said was the biggest worry I have is this person's kind of asking, is it better for tax purposes to withdraw yearly 4% rule? Take the money out as you need it. You know, the 4% rule is there to be sure that you're not taking too much out and you're going to run out of money, but there's no rule of thumb on here's what you should take out of your TSP when you retire.
Yeah, and tax-wise, it's going to be taxed at the individuals, and this is going to come out wrong, the highest bracket that they're in. I'm not saying the highest bracket there could be, but it's you have
marginal
a base level
rate
of income. This just
adds on top,
put
of
on
it.
Top of it. And Tammy just said this is called your marginal tax bracket, but it is usually your highest. Please don't misinterpret that. Say it's a high rate. It's the same rate as any other.
Well, if you
income.
Take a six-figure amount out of your TSP, it will be a high rate.
and you'll get less back.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. What surprises me sometimes is when someone thinks, because they really haven't thought about it yet, is that they're going to just take out their TSP when they retire and pay off the $300,000 left on the mortgage.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, please talk to the financial advisor before you do that, because there
I'll
can be so many ramifications of that you want to avoid. Because once you've done something, it's kind of too late to put it back. But if you haven't done it yet and you're planning, you can then point out, here's the pros and cons of each option. I love it when somebody asks the question before they've taken the action.
Well, that's a misconception. They think that they're in a lower tax bracket now because they retired, and they probably are. But then when you take $300,000 out of your TSP, you're right back in probably the highest tax bracket you've ever been in your life.
And you're going to say, uh-oh,
and
can I put it back in?
Yep, exactly.
There's not enough left.
Yep. Okay, now tax brackets, we all have tax brackets, and at a minimum, the retirees are going to get this annuity, wouldn't you say?
I mean,
you could wait, but why wait? And maybe they have Social Security, maybe they don't, depending on FERS or CSRS or both. So then the next amount of dollars, unless it's the Roth TSP, the traditional TSP, is just going to get taxed like the rest.
Ordinary income.
Yeah, it's just going, but it's going to go not necessarily on top, and it's generally not all three from the first day that they can. When you say, don't you usually wait till later to take money out of the TSP and let it grow? You're going to get the annuity. You're not going to stop the annuity. Social Security then is the issue. Do I claim it early or do I claim it late?
Mm-hmm.
So in between the time, let's say I want to claim it late to get the full benefit, then some money's got to come out of the TSP to help pay the bills.
Right.
How do you work around that?
That's one of my, I want to hear Tammy's opinion on this too, because we have different perspectives. I think my worry is if you delay it, obviously the math of it all can be run. You know, does it make sense to, if I take it at 70 and get a larger amount, how long do I have to live to offset what I didn't get for those first 8 years? And you can play with that math. But the sort of hidden factor there is if I don't take that money and I need the income, I've got to take it from somewhere else. So what am I paying in taxes? What am I losing in possible growth? I also, I would add one other little point is we don't know how long we're going to live. I could make the argument we don't know exactly how the Social Security system is going to evolve over time. I would say anybody who thinks they know exactly how that's going to work is probably not telling the truth. But my attitude has always been more, if I need the money, and I'm not working, of course, so I would need the money, then to take it right away. But I think you had some interesting perspectives on that.
Yeah, a couple of things is, number one, it sounds kind of crass, but I don't care if I die early because I won't necessarily need the money anyway. But I worry more about the fact
that's for your financial plan.
Yeah, I made it till 72. Yeah,
good job.
But on the other hand, if I live to be 90, that's my bigger fear.
Right.
Because now I've got, if I delayed my Social Security, and granted, I have to be able to afford to delay it, meaning I have enough other income that whether it's coming from savings or most of it's coming from my government pension, that allows me the luxury of delaying it till I'm 66 or even till I'm 70. Now I've locked in this bigger check that's going to get cost of living adjustments on a bigger amount. Mm-hmm. And that's going to come if I live to be 102. So that, along with my government pension, might be enough to let me stay in my same house, and maybe even a little long-term care insurance will let me hire a caregiver if I should need one later on in life. So I'm trying to look for some financial security for those of us who live a long time.
Right. That makes sense.
So that's one thing. And if you're part of a married couple, I think you have an extra benefit where
that's
one spouse can take it as soon as the getting's good. Mm-hmm. As soon as they stop working, if they're 62, go ahead and apply. Where the other spouse, usually the older spouse who might have a higher Social Security benefit, is going to get more bang for their buck if they delay it. So that difference between age 66 getting $2,600 a month versus age 70 getting $3,700 a month, that's $1,000 a month that's going to go even to the surviving spouse extra. So those are my arguments for delaying it.
I think
sometimes
the crux of our debate on this, and again, I don't know that there's a right answer. It's sort of an individual thing, but is to what, I don't say damage, that's an extreme word, but what are we doing to our assets and our plan between, you know, from when we retire to when we start taking Social Security.
Right. How much time is there? Is it 62 to 70?
Exactly.
Or is it 67 to 70?
And do I need that income? I mean, certainly I give the same advice that you do when somebody who says, look, I can live, if they're married, I can live off my federal retirement and one Social Security check. Let's delay the biggest one and get a bigger dollar amount down the road. The question is, if somebody says, I need this money every month, you know, what's the best way to handle it, to take Social Security sooner or to take money from investments? And it kind of depends on what those investments are.
I was going to say, call Joe.
yeah, that's where I think.
Because then you have to run a bunch of different scenarios to see how it's going to play out long term.
But I like the one that if you die sooner, you don't care. I like that. I'm going to use that.
I'm going to ask a question, then we'll take a break and we'll do the answer. Actually, one of the presenters, we have a debate on occasion, and they say, take Social Security the first time you can take it, and you got to be disciplined to do this, pay the tax, and then save it. And then at 70 and a half, when you otherwise would have hit the max, you draw down against this pot. Now, everybody think about that. We're going to take a break, and then hopefully we'll have a discussion. I won't say the answer.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here at a lively show, and we had a bridge from the beginning of the commercial to the end, and we talked about one of the presenters at NITP. We have a debate, and they say claim Social Security early, as fast as you can, but you don't spend it. You pay the taxes on it and put it into an investment, and then at 70 and a half, then you start to take it out at the full force to equal what it would have been had you wait. But you got this pot of money if you don't make it to that point or if you live beyond it. And Joe's looking at me like, why did you ask that?
Well, it's funny. It took me during the break to think it through, and then I've decided I don't love this idea at all, simply because my argument for taking Social Security early is that you need the money, that you're spending it versus taking money from some other source. You're flipping it and saying, I want to take it early to invest it and grow it in a way that offsets the benefit down the road that I can take more money from. To me, the Social Security, I think Tammy mentioned, it's like an 8% increase, you know, every year. To me, that's a hard hurdle to get over. I don't see the math working that way versus the opportunity cost of not taking it out of the TSP because you need the income, if I'm explaining that right.
Right, because what that's kind of telling me is that that person is living just on their FERS pension.
Yes.
Because now they're not taking money out of their savings.
They're playing
the TSP,
a game with it.
And then they're not taking their Social Security. So I don't know. Like you were saying earlier, Joe, if you have the money and you've saved it for your retirement, you have to enjoy it and you have to not be afraid to spend it a little bit so that you can live your life while you're young enough and healthy enough to do so. So I think there comes a point where you have to kind of let loose a little bit.
I always get away from some of these kinds of things. To me, almost seem like you get these questions in seminars. They're, can I game the system this way where the reality of people's lives are not that? It's, you know, no one's 75 years old talking about, ooh, I outsmarted the IRS and I beat the S&P 500. They want to know they can pay for their care. They want to know they can live their lives. So I try to avoid, not to blow up your whole idea here, Bob.
All right. Okay. Then let's switch gears. All right. So now the individual's got X dollars at, say, 65, looking at retiring, not so sure when it's going to be, 70 and a half. When you do your projections, the money's got to earn a certain amount to make up for spending habits, if you will. So do you ever do like a break-even analysis to say, if you don't do this, you're going to run into trouble at age 85? Or
absolutely. Okay. Yeah. And that max income illustration is another way to do that, is run it higher than what you think you're going to need just to protect yourself against the unforeseen.
All righty. What have been like surprises, both of you? Tammy, let's go with you. They didn't know they had this benefit in retirement.
Well, the one thing that I'd love to debate with Joe, or at least understand his point of view on this, because I get this question all the time. We meet a lot of federal employees who are married to federal employees, and they think because we're both going to have a government pension, we've both worked 30 to 35 years for the government, that we don't need to leave each other a survivor benefit, because I have my $4,000 a month from FERS and you have your $4,000 a month, and we each have $2,000 a month from Social Security. So while we're both alive, life is good. You know, we've got $12,000 a month before we've even touched our TSP. But I always warn them. I said, make sure you look at that for what if one of you dies first, and now it's one of us. So now you've lost one of those Social Security checks. You've lost one of those FERS benefits. And now can you live on $6,000 a month? And how much are you going to have to take out of your savings to make that same kind of lifestyle that you had while there was two of you? So what do you tell people, Joe, whenever you have two federal employees who have very similar benefits and incomes and age, you know, they're not too far apart. Like, do you think it's wise to go ahead and each of you take a reduced benefit, or is there some other way to provide for each other?
Yeah, and I want to hear what you have to say about this too. But it's, you know, let me start by saying it depends, because it definitely depends. But the two things I would say that are kind of factual in this decision is, number one, the survivor benefit is the way to protect the income. If you're gonna do anything to give your spouse something when you pass away, I would use the federal survivor benefit and not private insurance. The math just doesn't add up. So it's a fairly good economical deal. And the fact is that you're paying basically 10% if you do the full amount, 10% of your retirement. And when you, if like I'm married and my wife is a federal employee and she passes away, then not only do I get her survivor benefit, but I also get an increase in my own because I'm not paying the survivor benefit in mine anymore because I don't have a survivor. I think the fundamental question comes down to, if you're looking at a couple with all this income coming in, could they live off of one of the incomes? Right. You know, I have couples all the time that say, look, the only reason we live in this house is because my spouse wants it.
Right.
The minute that they pass away, I'm getting out of here and going back to my hometown or whatever, and I won't have a mortgage. I mean, there's other ways to think about it. If you need that full amount of income, then it does make me a little bit nervous to not choose the survivor benefits.
Right. I always use myself as an example, and I'm not afraid to say it because I think every couple has a spender and a saver. Usually one spouse is the one who likes to spend, the other one's the saver.
Which one are you?
I'm the spender.
Oh, okay. That's surprising. I didn't know that.
I know. Everybody gets surprised because all I talk about is saving for retirement, but yet if left to my own defenses, I would have nothing.
Gotcha.
So I always say that if I were the one to die first, my husband would be fine because he has his government pension. That's his savings plus mine if I didn't get a chance to spend it. So, and he lives very frugally. I mean, he still wears the same brand of tennis shoes he wore in high school, and he's 62 years old this year. So it doesn't take much to make him happy. Where on the other hand, if he died first, I'm in big trouble. Mm-hmm. So I've decided, and this has nothing to do with how long I'm going to live or anything. It's just I've decided that I'm not touching my savings. I'm not touching my Social Security while there's two of us.
Mm-hmm.
Because
we
have enough coming in. I don't need more money that I can find to spend.
Well, you're highlighting the nuance of it. I mean, that's what financial planning is that, you know, who's the spender, who's the saver, what's the age difference, you know, medical histories. I mean, there's all kinds of
factors.
Things. Do you have children that you want to leave money behind to? I think that's a question as well. You know, there's a lot of pieces
to
this, but I guess if I were to say one blanket statement is the way to do it in your situation is the survivor benefit, not trying to buy some sort of private insurance policy or some other alternate strategy.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll hear people say is that, oh, we have $1 million policy. And I said, what kind of insurance is it? And they'll say term. So, well, when's the term? Mm-hmm. Well, when I'm 72. I said, well, then what happens after you're 72?
Right, exactly. Yep. And where the survivor benefit is basically for a lifetime insurance that is guaranteed.
Exactly. With a COLA.
Okay, yeah, with a COLA too. That's
same
true.
Question to both of you. Tammy first. What about if a couple comes in and you're talking with them and they just really don't know how the benefits coordinate with regards to, let's say they're both feds, survivor's annuity versus not. Again, without doing numbers, Joe's going to do the numbers in a second and the thrift. Are they aware that they should have a survivor's annuity? That's crazy not to have one, but do they have a full one?
Yeah, like Joe had answered the last one, it depends on a lot of things. But what I like to show people is a visual. I like to make a chart and say, okay, here's your FERS and here's his or her FERS or whatever they have. They might be private industry. And here's your Social Security checks. Here's your balance in your investments. And this is why you're both living. So let's say, what if we X out one of you? You know, how does that leave the other one? You know, what's going to disappear? And then I try to put in some numbers for them. And so they can kind of see that from a concrete, very basic projection. And then if they're still not sure, that's when I'll say, you know, I have a list of financial advisors, and I think it might be wise to talk to one, because there's a lot of different ways you can cut this. And that's something that a good financial planner can really give you some perspective on that. And that's where I kind of turn it over to Joe.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a program for that? A computer program?
There's a lot of them that the public can buy on their own. I mean, there's plenty of software and things on the internet, and most financial firms, we have our own sort of internal software that factors in things like volatility and you know, the unpredictability of the markets, to take that into account as well.
That's probably pretty slick when you can watch that on a screen. Okay, let's assume X percent rate of return, and that's on green, and then Y percent might be on red or green.
Yeah, it gives you a sort of a, not to go deep statistics, but it gives you kind of a probability range, like a standard deviation, or if you will. And we kind of make it simpler by, it's even on the statements of our accounts where, you know, it shows you have a 95% chance of meeting your goals, and then the market goes down this month, and now you have a 94. You know, it gives you perspective that instead of the, oh, I lost 10 grand this month, well, my plan stayed the same. Right. So a lot of financial planning institutions do that, where clients are now getting their reports less about the dollars and more about the ability to meet their goals, which is, again, kind of the point.
Now, if they have accounts, I can't imagine that they would have an account any place but with you. But if they had two accounts, and one, you know, you do this great analysis, and the other one, we're gonna invest this ourselves.
Yeah,
they got to plug that in.
Yeah, then that has to be manually entered with the advisor to make sure they know your whole situation, because we can add that information, but it has to be added manually. I wouldn't have any way of knowing a daily balance of your account.
Okay. Biggest surprise when somebody thought they had it all together and you did the numbers and maybe they didn't?
I don't see a whole lot of that. I mean, I as far as the oh no meeting where they thought that they could retire and now they can't. I think I generally say, I think a lot of people feel like they need to be more aggressive than necessarily they do. And I think a lot of people are hesitant. And again, we deal with federal employees. There's a mentality of being more cautious and not spending money. And, you know, I run into that quite often, more than I have the, you know, well, I want this and I want that. And I'm just, you know, I'm in tons of debt, and I don't see a lot of that. And granted, if they're that, they might not come see me and get the lecture. So I might be getting a certain select group.
Okay. And Tammy, when you talk with folks, you understand the finances, but I think you're like me. You're not going to do the financial planning, but
I
you
can't,
understand
yeah.
it enough to bring it up.
Yeah. But in talking about, you were asking Joe about calculators, and I'm fascinated by those financial planning calculators, because they give you so much information, because what federal employees have available to them are very simple calculators that don't do that kind of projection.
Yep.
So when they go to their agency HR office, they can get an estimate run on a calculator of their FERS basic benefit or their civil service annuity. And it's going to tell them, here's how much you're going to get every month. And it might even show the withholdings for health benefits and life insurance and maybe a rough guess on taxes on the federal level. But that's it. It doesn't really give you that projection of your TSP included in that or Social Security added to it. So you can then go to SSA.gov or TSP.gov and likewise get very simple calculators of those benefits and kind of put that together. And that's kind of where I leave off. Is I can show people those three simple calculations and point out the fact that there's cost of living adjustments and there's elections for survivors that you have to think about. But that's where it kind of goes into financial planning. If we don't know if that's going to be enough, or if we don't know how to start withdrawing from the TSP or how to invest it after we retire. So I think there's a real blend of specialties like benefits, understanding your benefits versus understanding the finances and the taxes. And then it even bleeds into estate planning from there as well. So I think these specialties we cover in the seminar are there for a reason, because people need help in all of those areas.
Most of those calculators are quite static. That's the problem, is they don't take into account real life, which is varying amounts of income, varying amounts of market performance. That's where I think financial planning and all of this plays a bigger role, is as life deals you cards, how do you navigate your plan?
I think you need it. Even accountants need it, the financial side. You know, I can look at the ballpark estimate or somebody will, I'm not picking on the ballpark estimate, but that's what it is. It's a ballpark. Mm-hmm. And they said, look, and I go, well, you know, you need somebody to say, well, what if? Well, what if you don't make X percent? What if you make more than X percent?
Or what if you need long-term care? Or what if you spend more early in retirement and less later? I mean, there's some people want to travel a lot for the first 4 or 5 years of retirement and then don't want to do it anymore or have two homes for a period of time. I mean, there's so many factors that play into that that the static calculators and estimates don't really take into account.
So, again, both of you counseled a couple or an individual, and you know, it seemed to happen, so you're in pretty good shape. Not guaranteed, you're in pretty good shape. Let the moths fly out of your pocket. In other words, they didn't spend money, and now they got the money to spend. Do they ever get too much involved with spending, and now they need the aha moment, you can't keep this up?
Well, the only thing, it's kind of what I was hinting at just a second ago, is I have quite a few clients that right now they know they're in a higher spending phase. They have a house at the beach and they have a house here, let's say, and they're doubling the time. They know that's not their plan. They're not going to do that forever. I know somebody who's doing that. They're not going to do this forever and ever and ever. And so right now the expenses are a little higher, or there are trips that they're taking and things they're doing with their children and so forth that they know will go away or plan on them going away. So that's where the planning gets a little bit more dynamic in those calculations, and where the spending really comes into focus.
Okay. And I think one, pointing to me.
Yeah, your turn.
I think one of the things that I find people neglect to think about, or they just don't know how to think about it, is long-term care. Like, you know, I've got this plan in place. I've got $1 million in my thrift. I've got this wonderful government pension, but can that all fall apart if I should someday need long-term care? So we sometimes have a discussion about what are some of the options to take that into consideration, including a little bit of insurance might go a long ways towards giving you some sense of security.
And it's a fun thing you can do with a forecast. Well, I shouldn't say fun. It's never fun looking at long-term care. But you could put in there, well, okay, once I get done with my two-house period of life for 5 years, what if at 75 I have Alzheimer's and I have these increased costs? Just run a little hypothetical and say, what if that happened to me for 10, 15 years and I had to pay $7,000-$8,000 a month for care? What happens to my plan next? And so, I mean, that's another way to look at it.
Here's where my plan went awry today. Every week, but especially this one, I never ask how people can contact either one of you. I should do that midway through. So, Joe.
Easiest way is email. My email is my name, joseph.sullender@wellsfargoadvisors.com.
How do you spell Sullender?
Sullender.
Okay, Tammy?
Well, you can go to my website, retirefederal.com, or you can contact me through NITP.
Okay, retirefederal.com.
Yep.
Nice website.
Pretty simple.
Okay, great. Boy, this has been a fast show. Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to listen to it because I'm not so sure I absorbed everything. Anyway, thank you both for being here. And everyone else, thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.